and work for America first. Welcome to another edition of American Countdown here on Thursday, June the 4th, 2020. The question resolved tonight, who is behind the riots? We know of the participation of BLM, Black Lives Matter. I know from the Attorney General and from common sense and from knowledge of recent history, the role and involvement of Antifa and Antifa-allied groups. We know of the media's participation by exaggerating certain risks, building fake narratives, and hiding the degree of looting and burning and arson taking place. The question is whether it could be coordinated with the help of some one or ones more powerful even than those groups individually on their own. Where do those groups partially get their funding, their support, their subsidy, their ability to organize in the first instance? So that's a question we will explore tonight. First, there is a good article called Connoisseur of Chaos in the City Journal, which is published by the Manhattan Institute, which goes into the history of one George Soros. As it details, George Soros, a man who you probably don't know, was convicted of insider trading a long time ago. He's someone who managed to get fantastically wealthy without building anything, without making anything, without apparently selling anything, without employing very many people. And he appeared to come almost from scratch to that degree of billionaire wealth and then has used it to influence politics. What is less known about him is that he's been accused of insider trading on multiple contexts, including his backing of the alleged Ponzi scheme Herbalife. But he was actually convicted of it when a court actually took him to trial in France. He was found guilty and levied a fine of millions of dollars. But there's more to who George Soros is. There is sort of a Sorosian world order, as this article goes into detail, where Soros declared that the main obstacle to a stable and just world order, in his view, is the United States. He sees the United States and nationalism as his primary enemy, adversary to overcome and undo. Indeed, he sees a world of open borders and global governance. He's been open about this in his Open Societies Foundation that then funnels money to a wide range of grants and institutions, part of which ended up being leaked by a group of D.C. hackers who got into it and disclosed it to the world, disclosing the degree and the scope and the scale of it. WikiLeaks was also involved in exposing George Soros when they exposed the DNC leaks involving John Podesta because there were emails concerning the George Soros Institution in that regard as well. If you read his background, he grew up in Hungary and was there during Nazi Germany. His father believed in what's called Esperanto, the artificial language that he and other disciples around the world believed would eventually become the world's tongue. And that was, he believed there would be one language and one world. That's the ideology in which he was tutored when he was young. His second major influence was when he was listed as the adopted grandson of a Nazi officer in Hungary during the Nazi era. And in that respect, he actually openly talked about what his role was and how he was not bashful, ashamed, or afraid of the fact that he helped participate and watched on as this adopted grandfather actually went about looting Jewish wealth in the country. Let's take a look at that video clip.
You're a Hungarian Jew mm-hmm. who escaped the Holocaust mm-hmm. by posing as a Christian.
Right.
And you watched lots of people get shipped off to the death camps.
Right. I was 14 years old. And I would say that that's when my character was made.
In what way?
That one should think ahead, one should understand and anticipate events. One is threatened. It was a tremendous threat of evil. I mean, it was a very personal experience of evil.
My understanding is that you went out with this protector of yours who swore that you were his adopted godson.
Yes.
Went out, in fact, and helped in the confiscation of property yes. from the Jews.
That's right. Yes.
I mean, that sounds like an experience that would send lots of people to the psychiatric couch for many, many years. Was it difficult?
Not at all. Not at all. Maybe as a child you don't see the connection. But it created no problem at all.
No feeling of guilt.
No.
For example, that I'm Jewish, and here I am watching these people go, I could just as easily be there. I should be there. None of that.
Well, of course, I could be on the other side, or I could be the one from whom the thing is being taken away. But there was no sense that I shouldn't be there, because that was... well, actually, funny way, it's just like in markets, that if I weren't there, of course I wasn't doing it, but somebody else would be taking it away anyhow. In other words, whether I was there or not, I was only a spectator, the property was being taken away. So I had no role in taking away that property. So I had no sense of guilt.
Notice that when he talks about no sense of guilt, but also when he says that he was only a spectator, it's the one time in the interview that his eyes close, which can be a telltale sign of somebody that's lying, that he may have been more than just a spectator in facilitating the confiscation and looting of Jewish wealth during the Nazi era. There is this sort of hagiographic, mythical portion of George Soros' time during that era, in which if you get to the YouTube favored media publications or favored videos or other forms of media propaganda, you'll see they claim that they'll suggest that he changed his last name. His family changed their last name in order to escape the Holocaust. That's completely false. He was a co-complicit participant in activities that took place in the Holocaust. They had changed their name before then. The reason why they changed their name was to follow that Esperanto religious language belief, to change the name to Soros to mean to soar, as part of this idea that there would be one language, that there would be one world, and that this would govern all. That's where the mindset and mentality comes from, and it's one of the many propaganda components of George Soros' story that is hidden from the institutional and establishment press. In the same capacity, he described his following of a Viennese professor, Karl Popper, that where he got the idea for the Open Society and the name of its current foundation and political institutes that spread money around to those who will destabilize governments around the world. He described it as, quote, a place free of tribal affinities like religion, like nationalism, like traditional economics. This is someone who does not believe in traditional religion, sees it as a threat, doesn't believe in national identity, sees it as a threat, doesn't believe in traditional economic formulas, sees it too as a threat, though he has got fabulously rich while banking and betting on the crises that take place around the world. In that capacity, the article goes on to detail how he actually told people early on that the reason why he stayed, he was going to just make some money and retire and be a philosophy professor, but that stopped quickly because he decided he liked the money and his, quote, self-importance. As he himself puts it, to put it bluntly, I fancied myself as some kind of God. That's what George Soros himself said to others, and why he continued to do what he did and why he continues to operate as he does. Indeed, there are a few, if you look at how he's actually made his money, as the article details, quote, there are only a few speculators who have so profited from disasters and crises like George Soros has. Indeed, often he can be seen as complicit in creating those crises, particularly in currencies and other aspects, by his influence in the markets. He believes in that. He believes that he can take certain actions that can cause the markets to react in a certain way to enrich himself at the expense of the public and at the expense of various governments. Indeed, as he described it during the 2008 financial crisis, where, again, he got fabulously wealthy after he had almost busted the Bank of England about 15 years before, famously, he said, quote, I'm having a very good crisis, he told the reporter. Once again, crisis for Soros is opportunity, opportunity for personal wealth, opportunity for pushing through his political objectives and agenda. Indeed, leaked emails and papers from the Open Society that DC leaks exposed back in 2015-16 detail about how he saw the Syrian refugee crisis as, quote, an opportunity to rethink migration's governance. Translation, use agitprop to flood Europe and the U.S. with refugees as a way to bring about the world that he wants to believe in, one where old borders and institutions are irrelevant, one in which American exceptionalism is no more. Indeed, he has long been an opponent of the state of Israel and has done everything possible to undermine its existence and its political support, including donating millions of dollars to various organizations that have ties to Palestinian terror operations. Further, the leaks also further exposed his willingness and readiness to shape media coverage, including, quote, let's select journalists from the five target countries and offer them long stay reporting trips. And this was his involvement in the complicity of overthrowing the government of Ukraine. If you want to understand the way his mindset mentality operates, this is someone who grew up in an era in which governments were overthrown with ease. And he has helped facilitate the overthrow of many of those governments throughout Eastern and Central Europe. Many of the color revolutions have had complicity of various government agencies as well, but they appear to be indigenous, organic, authentic revolutions of the street. But often they turn out to be orchestrated, organized, coordinated. That is why he is called headline describes him, quote, the connoisseur of chaos. One could also call him the creator and coordinator of chaos. He does it by infiltrating media groups, using what's called NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and does so through funneling money in a wide range of means and mechanisms to basically infiltrate movements and instigate rebellion. And he's accustomed to seeing that work, letting that sink currencies, letting that destroy economies, letting that overthrow governments, as it has in many parts of Eastern and Central Europe when he was a kid, and as many parts of Eastern and Central Europe now with his own influence, creating that possibility and that outcome. Now, what is one of George Soros's favorite groups? Well, this article details, Soros's favorite is Black Lives Matter. He has helped create it. He's helped fund it. He's helped push the fake narratives that surround it to the degree that now we're even seeing the former Clinton campaign manager and other high profile individuals, including members of Congress, call for literally defunding the police. Los Angeles is even talking about diverting large amounts of money from the police into groups as directed by Black Lives Matter. Imagine a world without the police. That's the world we're witnessing right now in many city streets across the country. It is a world of chaos, of violence, of disorganization. Indeed, the police is the sort of the thin blue line between criminality and chaos and an organized society rooted in its traditional institutions and American constitutional law. George Soros is someone that helped facilitate, promote, and propagate Black Lives Matter with his substantial funding in a wide range of directions. In the same context, he's not only funded various forms like illegal immigration organization and attacks on the Catholic Church. Well, dig deeper into Black Lives Matter's other strange affiliations and associations. And what you'll find is that Black Lives Matter often focuses obsessively on issues of illegal immigration, issues against the church, including promoting various issues related to more extremist aspects of gay and lesbian politics. Does that sound like a group rooted in actual black lives that actually would be concerned with actual black lives? Or is that a political template to create insurrection in the country along the lines of George Soros's agenda? Indeed, if you read and watch and go through what Black Lives Matter supports and subsidizes, what they patronize and propagate, what you will find is an organization that is almost strictly in line with George Soros's agenda, but not one that is aligned with the street, that is aligned with black business, that is aligned with black churches, that is aligned with the cornerstone and the foundation of black civil rights in this country going on over more than a century. Maybe that's not a coincidence. Maybe that is not merely chance. Indeed, if we take a look at it, I'm not the only one who has that viewpoint. The Lord Jamar, someone that's influential within, that comes from the street, that's influential in black civil rights movements as a political figure himself within the musical and cultural industry for the African American population. This was his view of Black Lives Matter. Let's take a look at video clip number 10.
And I'm not no Black Lives Matter supporter.
Like, you're not?
No, absolutely.
Why not?
Because it's not our movement. This is a movement that was given to us by, you know, isn't George it? Soros and his fucking boys. because they saw how things were going and they didn't want it to go back to the 60s to where we start having our own organic movements. That was a big problem for them. So let's give the people a movement that we can control. We'll provide them the leaders and all of this type of, and yeah, that's what Black Lives Matter is. Look at the leaders of Black Lives Matter.
Are there leaders of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah. Who? Look at these lesbian women who are trying to incorporate, you know, LG, whatever the fuck the letters are, incorporate those, their concerns into Black people's concerns. Go to the website. Look it up. Google, well, George Soros and Black Lives Matter. See what comes up.
Let's look it up.
Okay. And you know, y'all out there, George Soros is a fucking multi-billionaire down with, you know, some of the 12 richest people in the fucking
world. He raised $100 million.
Yep.
For Black Lives Matter Coalition. The funding comes in addition to more than $33 million in grants from top Democratic Party donor George Soros. Okay, here we go. Okay, so, So
what billionaire would have done that for the Black Panther Party?
33 million. Well, hold on.
Huh?
Hold on. In high school, I read some books about the Black Panther movement.
Mm-hmm. Charlton Heston, maybe people like that.
Indeed, that's revealing how people on the street really see Black Lives Matter that have actual grounding and roots in the civil rights movement. Indeed, in this respect, if we look at other people's opinions about the strategies taken by Black Lives Matter and how it backfires, consider a Professor Lowry who had a recent discussion with another professor, and he outlines the problems with taking this approach, and he's trying to appeal to those on the left. So he even plays into the caricatures they have of middle America and white militia members and things like that. But he's explaining that if you actually believe any of this, the idea that you're propagating is hurting, because rather than universalizing the causes and issues that relate to police abuse, rather than looking at actual solutions, you're creating a divisive logic and a divisive politics that will backfire. It will backfire because it will highlight issues related to black on white crime that will not be productive and positive for civil rights advancement in the country. You're also denying people the recognition and reality that police abuse affects all people of all races and all religions and all backgrounds. And he outlines and explains the difficulties with that kind of agenda and why he opposes the BLM method of operation. Let's take a look at video clip number 3.
To your question, I have two answers. One has to do with the broadened base of political protest against the institutional practices that we abhor. Okay, this has to do with police training. It has to do with police accountability. It has to do with police rules of engagement, etc. So that's a serious issue of public policy. The more people that one has lined up to argue for reform in that area, the better one is. Casting the problem as a universal problem that affects all citizens gives you the chance of putting together a more effective coalition to get the policies changed. So more allies if I say we're all or susceptible to being victimized in this way, which is indeed the case. We are all susceptible.
Yeah.
Those African Americans will be statistically at greater risk. Yeah. But the other reason that I give is I just fear that the racialization of this kind of discourse, which is very far advanced now, invites a look at the full picture of criminal victimization, not only where the police are the perpetrators, and the overrepresentation of African Americans amongst offenders is a prominent fact about that situation. So if I start talking about people getting killed by people in a different race and I start just counting, how many white people are killed by black people? How many black people are killed by white people? There's a lot more white people killed by black people than there are black people killed by white people, even though blacks are a minority of the population.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of heinous crimes that are being undertaken where whites are being victimized by blacks, looking at the robbery statistics, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So, I mean, I fear the day when I have a mob of white people out in front of the courthouse demanding that black criminals who are perpetrating these awful crimes in our society be punished. And I think we're seeing it a little bit when we see militia-looking whites who are brandishing weapons out in front of their residential enclaves or their businesses, almost daring somebody to come up. I shudder to think what these conversations look like, which we enlightened on the coast will dismiss, you know, amongst just ordinary workaday Joes who happen to be white and like their hunting and fishing. And keep their weapons and appreciate their Second Amendment rights. I shudder to think, you know, we dismiss them on the coast as, oh, they're just a bunch of racists and white supremacists. You know, we think that we can rule them out of court because they're moral reprobates. Once this racialized conversation continues in this way, we invite a racialized backlash that I shudder to contemplate. So those are my reasons to think about it as something that's happening to Americans. Rogue cops who need to be held accountable and punished, and to enumerate the cases of white victims of this police violence as well as blacks, because I want a broad coalition and because I really don't want to have the crime and punishment or conversation in the country so thoroughly racialized. I think that works to the detriment of blacks in the long run.
It definitely works to the detriment of the black community in the long run. In addition, the whole mythology that BLM is built on, that this violence is racially targeted and racially directed and only about race, is one that has been rebutted and refuted, as we have on this show, going through the studies by black liberal professors from Harvard who showed that, in fact, there was no disproportionate shootings and killings of black men in America when he went back and looked at a long range of data. Recently, Tucker Carlson took a look at just the cases that happened in 2019, showing that, indeed, there is no genocidal epidemic as BLM is trying to pitch. Let's look at video clip number 8.
Since 2015, the Washington Post has maintained a comprehensive database of fatal police shootings in this country. Last year, the Post logged a total of 1,004 killings. Of the 802 shootings in which the race of the police officer and the suspect was noted, 371 of those killed were white, 236 were black. The vast majority of those killed were not, in fact, unarmed. The vast majority were armed, and African-American suspects were significantly more likely to have a deadly weapon than white suspects. Yet more white suspects were killed. Overall, there were a total of precisely 10 cases in the United States last year, according to the Washington Post, in which unarmed African-Americans were fatally shot by the police. There were 9 men and 1 woman. Now, as we said, a lot is at stake. The country is at stake. So we want to take the time now to go through these case by case into the specifics. The first was a man called Chinara Feep. He was killed by a Knoxville police officer called Dylan Williams. According to Williams, Feep attacked him, choked him, and then used a taser on him, the suspect on the police officer, before the officer shot him. 5 eyewitnesses corroborated the officer's claim, and the officer was not charged. The second case concerns a man called Marcus McVeigh. He was, by any description, a career criminal from San Angelo, Texas. He'd been convicted of aggravated assault, assault on a public servant, and organized criminal activity. At the time he was killed, he was wanted on drug dealing charges. A Texas state trooper pulled him over. McVeigh fled in his car, then he fled on foot into the woods. There he fought with a trooper and was shot and killed. The officer was not charged in that case. Marzua Scott assaulted a shop employee. When a female police officer arrived and ordered the suspect toward her car, he instead charged her and knocked her to the ground. At that point, she shot and killed him. The entire incident was caught on body camera. The officer was not charged. Ryan Twyman was being approached by 2 L.A. County deputies when he backed into one of them with his vehicle. The deputy was caught in the car door. He and his partner opened fire. The deputies were not charged in that case. Melvin Watkins of East Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was shot by a deputy after he allegedly drove his car toward the deputy at high speed. The deputy was not charged. Isaiah Lewis, meanwhile, wasn't just unarmed. He was completely naked. Williams broke into a house and then attacked a police officer. The police tased Williams, but he kept coming at them and attacking. The officer shot him. They were not charged. Atiana Jefferson was shot by a Fort Worth deputy called Aaron Dean. A neighbor had called a non-emergency number after seeing Johnson's door open, thinking something might be wrong. Police arrived. Johnson saw them approach from a window and was holding a gun at the time. According to body camera footage, the officer shot Johnson within seconds. Jefferson, that officer has been charged with homicide. Christopher Whitfield was shot and killed in a place called Ethel, Louisiana. He had robbed a gas station. Deputy Glenn Sims said his gun discharged accidentally while grappling with Whitfield's. Sims, who is black himself, was not charged in that killing. Kevin Mason was shot by police during a multi-hour standoff. Well, Mason turned out not to have a gun. Mason claimed to have a gun, claimed to be armed, and vowed to kill police with it. They believed him. Mason had been in a shootout with police years before. And finally, the 10th case concerns Gregory Griffin. He was shot during a car chase. An officer called Giovanni Crespo claimed he saw someone pointing a gun at him. Later, a gun was in fact found inside the vehicle, and yet Officer Crespo was charged anyway with aggravated manslaughter. Those are the facts. That is the entire list from 2019, last year. 10 deaths. In 5 deaths, an officer was attacked just before the shooting occurred. That is not disputed. One allegedly was an accident. That leaves a total of 4 deaths during a pursuit or in a standoff. So out of 4, in 2 of those cases, in fully half, the officer was criminally charged. Is it possible that more of these officers should have been charged? Of course it's possible. Justice is not always served, that's for sure. But either way, this is a very small number in a country of 325 million people. This is not genocide. It's not even close to genocide. It is laughable to suggest it is. In fact, the number of police killings is dropping. In 2015, during Barack Obama's presidency, 38 unarmed black Americans and 32 whites were slain by police. Overall totals have fallen since then, and they have fallen far more dramatically for African American men. Last year was the safest year for unarmed suspects since the Washington Post began tracking police shootings. It was the safest year for both white and black suspects. At the same time, this country remains a dangerous place for police officers. 48 of them were murdered in 2019, according to FBI data. That's more than the number of unarmed suspects killed of all races. One final number for you, because it matters. In 2018, 7,407 African Americans were murdered in the United States. If 2019 continues on a similar trajectory, and we hope it doesn't, but if it does, that would mean that for every unarmed African American shot to death in the United States by police, more than 700 were murdered by someone else, usually by someone they know. Again, those are the facts. They are not in dispute. Are African Americans being hunted, as Joy Reid recklessly claimed on MSNBC recently? Or is something else happening? Is our nation being ripped apart by a total and complete lie, a provable lie, a lie used by cynical media manipulators and unscrupulous politicians who understand that racial strife, race hatred, is their path to power, even if it destroys the country? You have the facts now, and you can decide what's really going on.
Indeed, a path to power appears to be the modus operandi of those supporting BLM and other groups that we'll get into after the break. It does fit the path that George Soros himself has described as what he wants to achieve and attain, and he's put billions of dollars behind it. But we also can't exclude the possibility of some degree of rogue government involvement. Remember, it was the FBI who set about trying to set up the president over the past year, or the past 4 years. So we get to that and other issues when we come back after the break. Welcome back to American Countdown. We continue to encourage you to support our sponsor that makes this show possible. That's InfoWarsStore.com. In particular, they have something that's useful in this time of stress, a product called Chill Force, which uses known products that are backed up by science, including by independent publications like Healthline and WebMD, that have the products in it that have a known, long-standing, organic, natural ability to help reduce stress. You can use those products and other products. You can go to the store to buy whatever products you wish. As I like to say, you get the trifecta of making yourself healthier, wealthier, and wiser in one clean, neat step by buying products that support your health, like Chill Force and others, by making yourself wealthier because you're getting those products at a severe discount, currently at anywhere from 50 to 70% off, and making yourself wiser by supporting independent media networks that provide for this platform and others that make it possible for you to be the determiner of what is true and what is honest and what is accurate in this time of media manipulation and fake news narratives spread by billionaires and big tech alike. So use this as an opportunity to go to InfoWarsStore.com to get the products that you like that support what you want to make yourself healthier, wealthier, and wiser in the process. In this context, one possibility that cannot be excluded is the possibility of rogue government operatives or informants being involved at some level. Remember, we've watched the last 4 years as the hierarchy of the FBI, CIA, NSA, Department of Justice, and others coordinated and conspired with the media to spread fake news narratives about the president, to accuse him of collusion with a foreign government to steal an election. They did so despite knowing and having independent evidence and confirmation that their news stories were false, that their allegations were false. They went to great lengths to try to entrap a general who had no history of problems whatsoever, who after undergoing a macroscopic and microscopic investigation by the high-ranking members of the FBI, they found that there was no basis to pursue General Flynn. Yet they did so anyway. They doctored notes, fabricated records, falsified information, and helped produce a coerced plea that has led to now next week General Flynn having an opportunity to finally have his case dismissed at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which will be hearing arguments from both the government and General Flynn's defense, as well as Judge Sullivan, who will have his own attorneys present. They were willing and able to go to that degree to set up someone who's a high-ranking military official. You can imagine what else they've done and what else they're willing to do. So in that context, we cannot rule out the possibility of government complicity or rogue agent complicity at different levels. There's too long of a history of it to completely discard its possible role. In this capacity, we should recognize that not only does the president not have that degree of control over the FBI or the Justice Department or every police department, indeed, most of these police departments are in Democratic cities. The president's Department of Justice has mostly waged war against him until Attorney General Barr's appointment. Former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was actually being examined just today and yesterday about various activities he was involved in, where he denied knowing things that he should have known. Indeed, he signed things under penalty of perjury to obtain invasive FISA warrants, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was meant to prevent and prohibit and preclude spying on domestic U.S. citizens from its prior abuse prior to the 1970s and its expose by the Church Committee in the mid-1970s, which exposed most of these scandals that we know about, from MK Ultra to COINTELPRO. Those aspects were fully should have the protection was supposed to be that someone with a high rank would make sure all of the information in it was accurate and was based on reliable sources. He attested, Rod Rosenstein attested under penalty of perjury that it was. And now he admits he actually never even read what he signed under penalty of perjury. The U.S. government and state governments and prosecutors across the country try to put people in prison and do put people in prison for far less every day. So let's take a look at the video clip of Rod Rosenstein admitting he didn't actually read what he signed under penalty of perjury to invade the privacy and spy on the president's allies. Let's take a look at video clip number 4.
You just told Senator Lee you read the FISA application. At the time you read the FISA application, did you know that the primary source behind the Steele dossier had disavowed it and said it's not true?
At the time I reviewed it, and I'm not sure I read every word, but I certainly reviewed it, and no, I did not know that.
At the time you reviewed it, did you know that there was significant exculpatory material that was omitted from it?
Absolutely not.
At the time you reviewed it, did you know that a lawyer on your staff had fraudulently altered material as a basis for a FISA application?
That lawyer was not on my staff, but I was not aware of it.
It was on the FBI staff?
Correct.
And the FBI reports to the Deputy Attorney General?
Correct.
So there he is admitting that he didn't even know what was going on when he didn't read even every word of something he signed to and attested to as being true under oath to the most invasive court known to man. That's the kind of people that have been involved in high-ranking positions within the Justice Department and within the FBI. So we cannot preclude that there are rogue agents and officers who would like to see the president undone by other illicit methods. And for it, we should know its history. In addition, we have local politicians that can do things that facilitate the spreading of rioting and looting. For example, we had played the previous a press conference of the Baltimore mayor in prior years, admitting that she ordered the police to, quote, give space for the rioters to, quote, destroy, a safe space to loot, admitted that right to the press in public. In addition, there was a history of the issuing of a stand down order in Charlottesville that helped facilitate the violence there, as was then reported by the ACLU while on the ground and by interviews with police officers who were being told not to do something that could have prevented any of the violence from ever occurring in the first place. Indeed, they actually steered the various groups to one another to facilitate the spread and the existence of violence, and then used that violence to blame the president and attack him. So there's definitely the possibility of that degree of complicity, and we're seeing evidence of it already. According to the Attorney General of Missouri, who put out this tweet, in a stunning development, our office has learned that every single one of the St. Louis looters and rioters arrested, so this isn't just all of the looters and rioters, it's the ones they were able to arrest, were released back onto the streets by the local prosecutor, Kim Gardner. By the way, there again, you might want to look at where some of these DAs that have been newly elected, particularly across the country, got their funding back in 2018. What you'll find is repeatedly George Soros' connection to helping take over local prosecutors' departments that effectively control police departments all across the nation. So here you have a local prosecutor making sure that all of the people that were doing the looting and rioting were right back onto the street right away, right after they had been arrested, destabilizing confidence in the police, destabilizing confidence in the criminal justice system, and encouraging and incentivizing the continuous rioting and looting to occur. This has been facilitated in the state of New York by its changing of its bail laws to basically allow for people to get out quickly and easily, even when accused of dangerous crimes. Indeed, that was propagated by AOC and other New York politicians who pushed that agenda. We already have a constitutional provision that guarantees that bail cannot be excessive. That's the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. It had always precluded and prohibited excessive bail. So the idea that we needed any additional no bail statutory changes in order to assert and execute that constitutional amendment is simply not accurate or true. The fact that you have some judges who fail to follow that is reason to seek civil rights reform and enforcement of the Eighth Amendment, not to completely ban bail either in practice or by law, which is what's happened and has helped facilitate the spread of violence across the country. In addition to that, we have other aspects in which the government can help facilitate these activities. Indeed, not surprisingly, maybe to some of us, one of the people that were involved in the criminal activities in New York, including Molotov cocktails and preparing bombs, was someone who turned out to be a couple of high-end lawyers. These lawyers were quickly bailed out by, guess who? A former intelligence analyst who worked in the State and Defense Department during the Obama administration was the one who quickly guaranteed bail. In fact, she called the person who firebombed a police vehicle, quote, her best friend. So you have to ask yourself at this point, to what degree is there government complicity or involvement in what took place? Indeed, if you go into detail, you find this person has ties to the U.S. Attorney's Office. You find this person has ties to the Islamic Scholarship Fund, has a wide range of ties to a range of political organizations that facilitated this criminal activities to riot and loot the city of New York. In that capacity, we should look at the history of government informants in law and supposed infiltration activities going back to COINTELPRO. The Intercept went back and detailed all the different times that government informants have been caught, including recent times. This includes a case in Austin where Brandon Darby acted as an informant and got two individuals to decide they're going to go firebomb and do Molotov cocktails at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, to which they ended up having to do plea deals because of the risk of time they faced, even though it turned out that they were likely, the whole idea started with an FBI informant. In the same capacity, there were other similar cases of that happening at the convention. It turned out that state troopers were assigned to infiltrate a group and create a pretext for a raid on that group by getting them to commit to violence that they themselves had not actually originally agreed to do. In the same capacity, and by the way, then some of those people are connected to radical lawyers that in turn now are connected to district attorney's offices, thanks to George Soros. In 2008, the Italian prime minister, the former Italian prime minister, Francesco Cossiga, went into detail about how he instigated those kind of tactics in the 1970s to undermine the various leftist and other insurrectionist groups in Italy. And here's what he wrote and told the new prime minister at the time that he recommended they do. Quote, they should do what I did when I was interior minister. Pull back police from streets and colleges during riots. Infiltrate the movement with provocateurs ready for anything. And for 10 days, let the protesters devastate the shops, burn down the cars, and set cities aflame. Then, emboldened by popular support, police have no mercy and can send them all to the hospital. Not arrest them because prosecutors would just free them right away, but beat them all and beat the professors that encourage them. So you do have people within the government, within governments around throughout our entire history and around the world that have engaged in instigation of behaviors that was meant purportedly to catch criminals, but often appeared to be more about entrapment than in fact, and unleashing in the process dangerous and precarious violence. Indeed, if you go through, there was an FBI informant that helped burn down a building at the University of Alabama. There was other informants that in the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, that encouraged them to kidnap a congressman and gave training on how to do Molotov cocktails. In addition to that, there was another FBI informant who was part of the Weather Underground that took part in the bombing of a Cincinnati public school. There was another FBI informant in Seattle that encouraged a person to place a bomb at a local real estate office. There was another FBI informant who bragged that he taught people how to do things, including the ones that were going in and burning and destroying different files in the 1970s in government buildings. There is the excerpt from the church committee that we've played from Gary Thomas Rowe, who was a Klan operative, but was actually an FBI undercover informant with the Klan, who facilitated and participated in the Freedom Rider beatings, who facilitated and participated in other shootings of individuals who may have been involved in the bombing of the Birmingham church, someone who was involved in various movements that helped facilitate violence across the country, often making the FBI aware of them in advance and the FBI either acquiescing in it or going along with it. Indeed, of course, as we've noted, Mark Felt was the one who helped organize that. And that reminds us, the past is prologue, as Shakespeare famously said. And so the point is, if we go back in history, we'll see these rogue aspects of the FBI involved in instigating violence around the country to justify their own existence or to serve an ulterior political agenda to undermine civil rights or civil liberties or other aspects of government. And they were often hostile and adverse to the elected president. Because remember, it was Mark Felt who ran COINTELPRO, and we'll get into more details about it in here in just a minute. But Mark Felt was the one who who Nixon recognized was dangerous, wanted to de-Hooverize the FBI for its rogue activities because Hoover had been blackmailing every prominent politician and members of the press for the better part of four decades, recognized that was a danger and a threat to a functioning democracy. So Nixon decided to de-Hooverize the FBI, pass over Mark Felt, and put someone else in charge of the FBI. How did Mark Felt reward him? Mark Felt decided that he became Deep Throat. He was the one who coordinated the coup against President Nixon, using President Nixon's own problematic behavior to achieve that outcome, but in the process and getting to disguise his role anonymously with Bob Woodward and others, who mostly disguised his identity because if people knew the COINTELPRO head was in charge of actually illicitly leaking information to undermine an elected president, they might perceive that set of events very differently than if they knew who he, than by not knowing who he was and thinking he was just a guy who liked to smoke a lot and hang out in garages, underground garages, as the film tried to portray it and as the book portrayed. Indeed, if you go into further detail, just since 9/11, the FBI indicted over 150 people in sting operations, but when they did further investigation, it turned out none of them were up to any criminal activity until the FBI got involved and inspired them and instigated the conduct to take place. Indeed, there was also a case of an environmental activist who was prosecuted for attempting to engage in domestic terrorism, but it turned out the FBI had withheld evidence in the case that, in fact, all of it came from a government informant who was trying to instigate the behavior in the first instance. They try to take people who are already politically radical and they radicalize them some more, instigate them to engage in violence, help train and tutor them in the ways to commit violence, help give them the means and mode and method of committing that violence. And that has been going on since the 1930s. And frankly, it has not stopped. So we cannot rule out that possibility of occurring in this context. Indeed, there are two videos that we can't independently verify, but two videos that raised questions about whether there was someone else complicit and undercover agents involved, either in passing out bricks or in actual affirmative violence. Let's take a look at video clip number six.
Are those bricks? What are those?
Those look like bricks. Look, yeah, those are bricks.
What the?
That's what they're doing. They're doing that for undercover police officers that are getting involved in the protests so that they have an excuse to beat the shit out of people. So
basically what you see is what appears to be police officers in a police type vehicle with bricks underneath the various packages that they have, that they're carrying bricks and appear to be planning on distributing bricks. So we can't know for sure, but this is in fact video that someone shot and that was their conclusion. What we do know is that bricks have been showing up in almost all these cities and counties where all the riots are taking place across the country, and just big pallets are left by construction places and other locations that did not serve a construction purpose. Sometimes they're just lined up along the street. And then, in fact, as one activist protester saw someone driving up in a Mercedes giving people these bricks, she called him out and complained about it. But this does look like and appears to be potential evidence of potential participation or instigation of the riot activities that may be taking place. We cannot rule it out completely at this juncture. In the same capacity, people at the beginning of the Minneapolis riots believed they spotted someone that was behaving unusually, that they weren't part of any group. They sort of came out. They started breaking windows. They were in a mask. They later think they identified them. Now, the methods of identification are clearly in question, but you can make your own determination. Let's take a look at video clip number five. So what happened was they spotted someone that was carrying an umbrella, sort of dressed like Antifa, but by themselves. They had a gas mask on, and people started asking questions because they saw him breaking local windows and that he was one of the first people to commit violence in Minneapolis. Then he sort of walks off on his own. They did a facial comparison and believed he looked like a St. Paul police officer. Can't clear, you know, don't know for sure, but at this point we can't rule out the possibility of various rogue agents being complicit or participant in this activity, either for their own motivations or for others. Indeed, in that capacity, it's useful to go back to the long history of COINTELPRO. The COINTELPRO was first exposed in March of 1971 when a group of activists decided to burglarize the FBI offices in Media, Pennsylvania. The FBI used to maintain offices in small towns all across the country. The reason for it was to have a FBI sort of PR presence, but it was also to be able to effectively infiltrate small and local communities. Now, part of that infiltration clearly included COINTELPRO based on what was discovered that day. They were able to break in, get the files, and they were the first to find out about COINTELPRO because some of the COINTELPRO's files were kept at that office. It also showed the scope and scale of COINTELPRO that such files would be maintained at even a small office in Media, Pennsylvania. Now, what did some of those files disclose? One, they disclosed the what one article entitles the FBI's War on Civil Rights Leaders. It goes into all of the activities to infiltrate civil rights organizations, to plant informants in those organizations, to plant disinformation in those organizations, to send bogus letters to them, threatening them in different ways, to try to find embarrassing personal information about them and send that to their wives or their family members, including Dr. King, who was a primary target of a lot of this illicit activity. Indeed, another article called it the FBI's secret war. The COINTELPRO program would go on for almost 40 years. It would also infiltrate a wide range of groups, including, in particular, black civil rights groups, but also anti-war groups or any other groups. Indeed, there was something they actually called the Ghetto Informant Program, which was an intelligence gathering operation that they know about from at least 1967 to 1973, which involved a lot of informant activity, and guess what? riots and civil unrest. Indeed, they were connected to a wide range of riots and rioting activities, and many of their informants would either see it, participate in it, witness it, or be complicit in it. And the last wave of riots we ever experienced was in that time frame. After that, we've only had very rare and occasional riots. Indeed, later there would be stories about Malcolm X's daughter being set up by informants, trying to get her to plan to assassinate Louis Farrakhan in the name of claiming that Farrakhan was responsible for her father's death, when in fact the evidence would show otherwise. And we can maybe show that this is sort of the context in which there have always been historical alternatives to this method of violence, like you saw from Professor Lowry, like you saw from the other folks who have been questioning and criticizing Black Lives Matter. And that goes back to the alternative offered by Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. During their times alive, they held all kinds of riots, and they didn't hold any riots. They held all kinds of protests, all kinds of marches, with no rioting and no looting, both of them. They were both committed to nonviolence. Indeed, if you dig into the FBI files, they actually admitted and acknowledged that. You had agents writing in saying they're simply, they're committed. Both the Nation of Islam and the civil rights groups are both committed to a public peaceful protest because they think that's essential. Believed in self-defense, they did not believe at all that that self-defense, like Antifa, extends to affirmative violence. They opposed it, they rejected it, and they were able to organize rally after rally, protest after protest, without any violence occurring for the better part of two decades. So, and yet then both of them would end up dead by 1968. Their deaths would end up implicating various government agents and informants who knew about it or were involved with it at some level. Indeed, we have that in the Martin Luther King case from the jury trial that took place in Memphis, Tennessee, decades later, where the jury concluded there was, in fact, a conspiracy to kill Dr. King and that it involved government informants and agents who were complicit at some level. The same is true of Malcolm X. A recent Netflix documentary details how his head of security, his top bodyguard, was actually placed there as an informant with a select department of the New York Police Department that was, in fact, working and operating at federal orders. Their goal, their objective, was to infiltrate the movement, undermine the movement. It turned out later some government informants were connected to the Newark division that was likely responsible for his assassination to such a degree that they framed two innocent people to go to prison for a long period of time who had nothing to do with it. So there's a long history of COINTELPRO kind of role and rogue government operatives that we can't be completely dismissive of. But when we come back after the break, we'll be discussing the degree to which this may involve other participants as well. Welcome back to American Countdown. If you dig into the COINTELPRO files, and you can find them at the FBI's FOIA, Freedom of Information Act page, they go into thousands and thousands of pages, and this is just what we know. Many of Hoover's files were never found. Many other files may have been shredded, and in fact, they admitted many files were shredded and disappeared in the Church Committee hearing process. But let's just take a look at the FBI's investigation, their FOIA files into Minneapolis, Minnesota, since that goes back to then where they are investigating the quote-unquote New Left. If you go into the files, the FBI formatting for these, you'll often see internal memorandums. You'll see how FBI agents do reports, how they copy articles. Some sections are still redacted. Now, it's from the special agent in charge in Minneapolis. So this gives you an idea that this was being run at the top, was being coordinated, and everybody sort of knew that had a critical role. It was to the director, Hoover himself. It was part of their quote-unquote counterintelligence program. Remember, it was the same counterintelligence units that tried to undermine President Trump during the campaign and then coordinated Operation Crossfire, Hurricane, and all the rest of them to take out the president's key men and ideally take out the president himself. So the mentality and mindset of these people has not meaningfully changed, and it's not a group of people that can be trusted. In the memo, they describe how, quote, by bureau letter, dated this letter, authorizing anonymous mailings of copies of articles. So here they were doing, taking articles that they think had negative information about it or someone else and would use, pretend to be an anonymous individual, sending it to either media people or other people that were connected to folks for the purposes of spreading disinformation or harmful information to those that could be within the movement. Goes, the letters were mailed anonymously, typed on paper obtained from a local source. So why did they do that? They wanted to make sure even the paper could not be traced back to the FBI. The envelopes were obtained as regular stamped envelopes to the U.S. Post Office. This way, again, by not using, by every aspect that they're doing, they knew by how they investigated crime, how to cover up their own criminal conduct, by making sure that nothing could be tracked or traced back to them. We only know about this because of the internal memorandums that were discovered during the Church Committee era and that were disclosed during the media burglary that took place of FBI files. In addition, they said that they mailed them from the university station in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So again, they're making a, they're creating a fake pattern of someone from the university doing things when they themselves are the ones doing it. That's just one example. Here's another letter. And here's the kind of things that it will say. A concerned gopher. This is one of their fake anonymous letters. Persons affiliated with this group have privately stated they have a communist individual's plans to visit with them in the near future. And they attach an article about how dangerous this person is. And then they enclose various article pieces and pieces of articles about it. They talk about pending counterintelligence activities, which involve who? Involved with the Minneapolis office. Often they were involved with local other federal agencies, like the Bureau of Narcotics that would later become the Drug Enforcement Agency. Also, they would infiltrate and be connected to the local police officers, as they disclosed that the Klan was connected to, the FBI undercover agent in the Klan, informant in the Klan, with Birmingham police officers. They go through details about how they're going to use an indirect manner, a discreet manner, how they're going to conduct it as if they're operating from the University of Minnesota when they're not, different ways that they're going to, different schemes they're going to have to try to embarrass and undermine the movement and sow disinformation within it. They talk about the different authorization that takes place to engage in all of these activities. And this is just what they actually memorialize, not what they didn't memorialize. Similarly and comparably, you'll find examples of that involving the investigation of civil rights groups during the same time frame. Indeed, they go through about the purpose of this endeavor is to, quote, expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, otherwise neutralize activities of groups they didn't like. And this included disrupting, exposing, misdirecting, discrediting, neutralizing leadership, neutralizing spokesmen, neutralizing membership, neutralizing supporters in the name of countering violence and civil disorder. But often to do so, they needed to create violence and disorder in those organizations' names. This goes back to the same thing the military was talking about in this time frame, Operation Northwoods in 1962 that would not be disclosed until 1998, where they talked about staging false flag terrorist events on U.S. soil in order to blame Cuba and justify an invasion of Cuba. And this particular outline of the plan went to every special agent in charge of every single office in the country. They go through about how they're going to do it. They're going to try to establish that these people are immoral or involved in subversive activity, have criminal records. Indeed, they're going to highlight the worst people involved in the movement in order to try to discredit the movement while also infiltrating them and instigating violent conduct. And this was a systematic plan for decades. Do we really think it completely disappeared from any government office or agency, given what took place? And that's why it's useful to remember why Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were such threats. They were individuals who promoted a distinct agenda. You can disagree with either King or X. More people disagree with the latter than the former. But recognize at the same time it was his appeal to the democratic roots of American government that helped produce the success of each of those movements, maintaining peaceable protest and lawful protest, but in the same time also doing so by encouraging self-empowerment, rooting their organization in local businesses, rooting their organization in the local church, rooting their institutions and their advocacy with policy analysts, with legislative reforms, with social change of a meaningful kind, not the kind that's defund the police. Not the kind that says bail for everybody no matter how violent your crime was. That wasn't their activities or their agenda. It was more focused on real, meaningful reform that could have substantial and substantive positive effects in their community. Let's just go back to a little clip of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King talking about the importance of self-empowerment within the African-American community, a message you strangely don't see or hear much at all from BLM and how they organize, where they got their funding, who their leaders are, what their policies proposed are, and what their activities are. Let's take a look at video clip number 7.
American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That's power right there if we know how to prove.
We should own and operate and control the economy of our community. We have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar.
We've got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money there. You have 6 or 7 black insurance companies here. Take out your insurance there. Now, these are some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a great economic base. We've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. We've got to see it through.
So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community, what we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community.
The black man must unite in one grand racial hierarchy, making a racial empire upon which the sun shall never set. Be black, by black, he's black, and all else will take care of itself.
It goes all the way back to Marcus Garvey, who had his own self-empowerment message of the 1920s and 30s. But King and X would both be killed because they offered an alternative to the kind of rioting politics we see today, a rioting politics that was unleashed not long after their assassinations. There was another way in which cities, counties, and states, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle, helped facilitate the expansion of riots in the 1960s. That's something we did not witness in the middle of the civil rights movement by King or by X. We all of a sudden saw, especially when both were killed and after that time frame, we saw all of a sudden saw an explosion of. Well, one of the ways that took place was the elimination of the riot liability laws. For almost our entire history, up until the late 1960s, any city that had, or any municipality, city, county, or state, that had a police force was considered strictly liable for any riot that occurred. They would be responsible for every penny, nickel, dime, and dollar of damage. Indeed, you can go to the old New York Times and look at in the 1860s during the New York riots, the draft-related riots concerning the Civil War in the 1860s, almost a century before, and see the people who outlined all of the financial items that the city of New York had to pay because of the damage that took place during the draft riots of that time and place. So indeed, that was the norm. If today cities would be held liable and have to write a check for the millions of dollars of damage in Minneapolis, for the millions of dollars of damages all across the country, imagine how the response might be then. Then maybe the police would be given the authority to maintain peace. Then there would be no incentive, no monetary incentive for the local municipality to give space, as the Baltimore mayor said it, to destroy. The removal of those laws in the late 1960s made it so that cities could no longer be responsible or liable for any damage or harm that takes place during a riot. Indeed, it's now almost just the opposite. If you intervene in a riot as an individual police officer and you do anything that later is labeled excessive force, then that's when you can be sued. You can't be sued for allowing the riot to destroy people's homes and lives, but somehow now you can be sued if you intervene in a way that somebody says was excessive later on. They effectively changed the law to create a system that would facilitate riots, that would effectively inspire riots, that would create a monetary motivation to not interfere or intervene in those riots. That law, of course, those legal changes have stayed on the books. You won't see much discussion or debate or dialogue about them at the time or now. It is something that has mostly been suppressed from our knowledge of legal history. But it's not the only kind that has taken place in this respect. It's also noteworthy that the George Floyd case could have been a uniting case. It was a case that did not promote the divisive agenda of BLM or of George Soros or others, but it was someone that a uniting agenda along the lines that Professor Lowry was talking about, where we recognize that could have been anybody's brother, father, or son on the ground with someone putting a knee on the back of his neck for more than 8 minutes when he was saying he couldn't breathe when he'd already been restrained. Indeed, in looking at it, it was a case where the police mishandled a situation of medical and mental health. One of the policy analysts and civil rights lawyers like myself, we have frequently brought suits trying to change how the police system, both in jails and prisons and on the street, handles issues that are better handled as medical health issues or mental health issues. Indeed, our facilities, whether you're going back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the book that turned into the popular film, can recognize that the way we handled medical and particularly mental health in this country was often barbaric rather than proper health protocols. That happens in the ways in which people commit suicide inside, even when they're on suicide watch. People commit self-harm by the very means and tools that they were institutionalized to prevent them from committing, by the various reckless acts of various individuals. And this happens also on the street. What the policy analysts and civil rights lawyers both recognize is that frequently the police are burdened with the obligation to be nurses and doctors to certain situations and scenarios that really require a medical response or at least the participation of someone who has medical background and expertise. Indeed, a former police officer who's a co-leader of Blexit recently discussed this in regard to the George Floyd case. It was clear from everything that was connected to George Floyd that the real problem, aside from the person being on the back of his neck, which may not have been the cause of his death, the real bigger problem was that this was an obvious mental health issue, not just a criminal issue, where there should have been mental health treatment rather quickly. There should be people that are participating with police when they're doing a combined mental health, physical health, police criminal call. Here, George Floyd had gone in, passed some counterfeit currency, according to the 911 call, to get some cigarettes, but then had come back and basically tried to negotiate that, and then was staying in the car. And the reason why they called in wasn't because they were worried about a $20 counterfeit bill. They called in because they said he was acting strange, behaving weird. He was showing signs that something of those who are trained, and police officers are trained in this, they're just not the best equipped to handle it, certain ways of people that are behaving that are experiencing the possible side effects of an overdose to something like fentanyl or the rest, or just simply experiencing the response to it when they're going on the downside of the physical equation. And there was evidence of that from George Floyd from the get-go, merely by the fact, first, the 911 call told them that, because they were calling in because they said he's acting weird and irrational ways. Second, he's still there when they arrive. So this is not someone who's out on some criminal spree, whatever his prior record may have been or prior history may have been. This is someone who's not in his right mind. Indeed, when they're trying to put him in the back of the car, he's acting very disruptive, but he's acting in a way that's counterproductive to his own self-interest. That's a sign that someone needed medical and mental health capacity, not a police response. I've dealt with this in other cases. I had a client who was an epileptic who was arrested, put into the jail. He told the nurses who pre-screened him, and they don't hire the best nurses for the jails. That's one of our problems. And he tells them that he is an epileptic and hasn't had his medicine. They don't treat him. They don't try to treat him. and he starts suffering the side effects of that, starts experiencing seizures. It gets so bad that his head is, he's bouncing his head against the floor of the cell. He's urinating on himself. He's defecating on himself. He's drooling on himself. Well, what was the response of the local jailers? Because they're ill-equipped to handle this, and they've almost, a lot of them who seek those jobs do so because they have, some of them have a barbarian instinct. That's just the reality of it. If you have, you're going to have a disproportionate problem in the police because the people who seek out police jobs are going to be disproportionately some of the worst people that we have. That doesn't mean most police are bad, but that just means that disproportionately your sociopath types would love to have a badge that allows them to go act on their sociopathology, a legal excuse, a personal pretext, a moral justification for their nefarious instincts and for their worst, most malevolent impulses. That's just the reality, and that's why we have a certain percentage of police forces that are going to be bad. There's ways to screen them out. There's ways to get them dismissed. That didn't happen in the case of George Floyd because Amy Klobuchar, when she was prosecutor, now senator, would-be vice president, New York Times endorsed candidate for the presidency of the United States, and if she was a vice president or Joe Biden, she'd be the de facto president if elected, given his near senility. And that she was the one that made sure that police officer was back on the street, someone that had a history of problematic interactions in these precise contexts. So George Floyd was someone who needed a response that reflected and recognized his medical needs, not the response of someone who was being treated like a bottom barrel criminal. I know it from the case I was co-counsel on in Milwaukee, because in that case, that was someone who, after he started experiencing those seizures, and even though he was banging his own head against the floor, he was defecating on himself, urinating on himself, drooling on himself. What did the local jailers do? They thought it was all part of some sort of antisocial behavior, that he was defecating on himself to get at the police, to get at the jailers. This is the kind of mindset and mentality that can take hold in police forces that have either inadequate training of medical health and mental health issues or do not have co-participation with people that have the degree of medical knowledge necessary to properly treat people or simply have sociopathic instincts and impulses that like treating human beings like a garbage bag. And that's what, in fact, they did in that case. So here was another example where a rogue cop is there. Thanks to a Democratic politician, the rogue cop doesn't have either the training or didn't act on that training. And as Brandon Tatum explains, this was founder of Blexit, former police officer, was a good athlete and football player before that, someone who grew up in difficult circumstances, who understood the community, who knew what training was supposed to occur, who knew what actions were supposed to occur. This could have been a uniting case that the riots and looting prevented us from being able to unite about. Let's take a look at video clip number one.
Yeah, if we had a training video to show you what not to do as a police officer and what not to do as responding officers, this would probably be a perfect example. I don't see or I don't have any information of what happened before this gentleman ended up on the ground. But what I can tell you as a police officer, a former police officer, is that it's unacceptable to have your knee on a man's neck for, I don't know, 8-9 minutes. There's no reason. He's handcuffed. He's on the ground. You have leverage over him and he's complaining of having medical issues. People are recording you and you still remain in a position that seems to be putting this gentleman at a life and death situation. So as a former police officer, any rational person, you should be rendering aid. You should back off of the guy. And there was a concept that I said in a video that I made on my YouTube channel is a concept of excited delirium. And a lot of people never heard of the concept of excited delirium. Maybe if you're not in law enforcement, you probably will never hear of it. But excited delirium is a theory that when people are hyped up on drugs, those uppers like PCP, methamphetamine, it gets your heart rate up, gets your adrenaline rushing. And what happens, you become a superhuman and then your body begin to crash. So you go down a path of crashing, kind of like if you drink sugar and then you get tired or sleepy afterwards. But this crash, it goes and it continues until you die. And we're trained as police officers to be able to observe that. And some of what Mr. George Floyd was experiencing seemed to be a level of excited delirium. So when a guy is going down like that, a police officer should back off, render aid, roll him on his side, make sure he can breathe because he could be hyperventilating. He could be having some distress that may not be a direct connection with your knee on his neck. And you should know that as a.
These are the training that police officers are given, but they're really just not equipped to be able to implement that in a live setting very consistently. That's why one of the mechanisms and methods of reform would be having more medical and mental health participants in responding to calls that either clearly have that issue but may also have a criminal issue, or often police are simply invited to situations and circumstances where they're asked to perform social work or mental health or medical help when they're not the most equipped and best established to do so. But that conversation was denied us by the rioters and by the looters, by those who wanted to manipulate the sequence of events to highlight divisiveness rather than unity, to do so along the lines that Professor Lowry talked about, having a racialized conversation about criminal justice that hurts rather than helps the African-American community, and it only involves the kind of destructive chaos that the so-called described connoisseur of chaos, the man who calls himself a god, like George Soros, could be inspired to see happen and occur. In that same context, in that same capacity, we have seen the perfect recipe for all of this be the various pandemic shutdowns that took place in many of these same cities, counties, and states. It helped facilitate the environment whereby all of this could occur in the first place. Indeed, in that regard, Paul Watson had a good recommendation, a good video, describing the insanity of this sort of woke virus that suddenly magically cured itself upon the existence of riots that facilitate either the Democratic Party's path to power or a George Soros policy agenda to undermine the United States in general and the President Trump in particular. Let's take a look at that video, clip number 9.
Remember that whole coronavirus social distancing thing? Remember how in both the US and the UK, the media denounced and publicly shamed anti-lockdown protesters for spreading the disease and killing Granny? Well, they've suddenly changed their tune, haven't they? Thousands of BLM demonstrators gathered in London today for more peaceful protests that ended with barriers being smashed, objects hurled at cops, and police officers punched in the face. So peaceful. Boris Johnson urged people to protest in accordance with social distancing. Yeah, really looks like they're doing that. Meanwhile, we can't hug our loved ones by law. It's illegal for us to get closer than 2 meters to our own parents, but this is okay. Anti-lockdown protesters are bad, spread the virus and kill Granny, and you'll be publicly shamed if you take part. BLM protests are good and don't spread coronavirus at all. You'll be publicly shamed if you don't take part. The same health workers in the US who berated stay-at-home protesters, even though many of them stayed inside their vehicles, for violating social distancing, are out on the streets today applauding far-left protesters for congregating in huge mobs with total disregard for social distancing. Authorities in New York were enforcing social distancing rules despite the fact that riots and looting were taking place just 2 miles away. People aren't even allowed to go to church, yet these rioters are venerated. We can't even go to the pub to see our friends, yet these people can swarm Downing Street in huge numbers and the media gives them a pass. Imagine if there was an Open the Pubs protest in London. Even if only 100 people turned up, the media and the left would be outraged. Attendees would be doxxed and harassed. Thousands gather in London to protest something that happened in a different country. Media, this is fine. Remember how much of a big deal they made out of that Atalanta-Valencia football match in Italy before the lockdown that they said was responsible for drastically spreading COVID? The media called it a biological bomb. This is London today. What changed? Let me emphasize, this is all in response to something that happened in a different country. UK police killed just 2 unarmed, meaning without a gun, people in the whole of 2019. One of whom was Usman Khan, the London Bridge terrorist. What are you even protesting? When an Islamic terrorist blew up a bunch of kids in Manchester, we were told, don't look back in anger. But when an American cop kills someone 4,000 miles away, people get angry. Then there's the whole Dominic Cummings freakout. The same people who just hyperventilated for over a week because a government advisor broke social distancing to arrange urgent care for his child are now gushing over a mass gathering of thousands of people in central London. What changed? Is coronavirus woke? Does it take a break exclusively for protests that champion left-wing causes? Or are you all just a bunch of massive fucking hypocrites? This Labour MP was whining about Cummings on May 25th. Just over a week later, he's bragging about breaking social distancing because virtue signalling is more important. Massive hypocrite. The UK media laboriously keeps telling us that coronavirus disproportionately affects BAME communities. Now, thousands of BAME people are in close proximity, potentially giving each other the virus. And the media celebrates it. Many of the protesters in London are school-aged teenagers. Leftists have aggressively campaigned against sending them back to school because of the threat of spreading COVID. Attending a protest with thousands of other people cheek by jowl, though, that's fine. As Ben Sixsmith writes for The Spectator, it's kind of amazing. For weeks, we have been arguing about the minute details of viral transmission. Can you be outside? How often can you be outside? Can you be with other people? How many? And how much distance should you keep from each other? Then masses of people gather in cities across the world for a protest, and the authorities do nothing. It just goes ahead. All those cancelled weddings, missed funerals, and never-to-be-had last moments with their loved ones that people were expected to endure, only to see other people doing this.
Indeed, we're seeing protest in the United Kingdom, protest in France, protest in Sweden, protest in across all of Europe, protest in Latin America, protest in Africa. The Chinese government is happy to pile on as well. Who has the kind of power and ability to organize international protests so quickly, so easily about these events, which spread a fake news narrative and facilitate rioting and looting in the process? Antifa itself, of course, is internationally rooted in an international organization, so it could help enact and enable the various violence that took place, but who else could help organize and orchestrate this? What movements? Who has the resources? Who has the objective to do so? When we come back, we'll talk about that and more, and we'll take some of your calls in the bottom half of the hour. You can dial in at 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539, or internationally, 512-646-1776. Welcome back to American Countdown. We continue to encourage you to support our sponsor, which has actually offering a severe discounted sale on ChillForce and a wide range of other products, currently 60% off. Indeed, ChillForce is useful to help you de-stress. I use it myself. It's a way to use alternative health that's rooted in natural health that has a long history, back into antiquity in some cases, of providing medical means and medical needs to serve our mental health without being dependent or reliant entirely or exclusively upon Big Pharma, who can be an unreliable partner in our mental health. ChillForce is particularly useful. It's 60% off right now. It's basically down to about less than $16 a bottle, which is extraordinarily cheap. And it helps promote and there's a 60% off across the board flash sale on a wide range of products currently at InfoWarsStore.com, where you can get healthier, wealthier, and wiser as well now at any time in order to support your mental and physical health while also supporting the information that's knowledgeable and your financial health by being able to get things at a deep discount off of what they would be against various market competitors. So we encourage you to continue to support our sponsor that makes this show possible in the first instance. In this regard, one individual also spoke out recently about the insanity of what was taking place, the necessity of the president using some form of force to be able to put down these quellous riots that are intended to create chaotic environments used to undermine both the United States and the president, and that was Joe Rogan. Let's take a look at a recent clip he had discussing the necessity of this action given the circumstances and situation faced. Let's look at clip number 2.
to be reestablished. And one of the reasons why I think that it needs to be reestablished is there's a fire of consciousness. And this fire is you're allowed to loot and smash and steal, and people are doing that now. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're doing it in the memory of George Floyd. And I think you got to put that fire out. Because once you allow people to do it like de Blasio did in New York City and force the police to stand back, people know they can get away with it. I've seen some horrific things, people running over people with cars and smashing into buildings, and it's fucking madness. When madness happens, you have to crack down. You have to do something about it. That's where I support, whether it's the National Guard or if the police have the resources, use the police. But something has to be done. When you're saying like President Trump de-escalating on television, that is not going to do a goddamn thing about those kids smashing windows. It's not going to change their attitude. They're not watching the news. They're not paying attention. They know they have a very simplistic perspective. George Floyd, this is bad. Black Lives Matter. Chaos. Smash that window. Take that shit. They're not going to say, hey, you know, when Trump got on his knees, I was going to loot Gucci, but I'm not going to do that anymore. They're not thinking like that. There's fake bullshit on both sides.
Yeah,
but you've got to do something to stop the fire. You got to put that fire out. Then de-escalate. But totally first, agree. The fire has to stop, because it's an obvious mob mentality thing. Because no one's ever seen this before. No one's ever. And there was a Santa Monica. There was a guy running around with a gun, pointing it at people. People are driving into fucking people and knocking them over. It's crazy.
It is.
It's not something that anyone expected 7 days ago.
And it is a sign of like a breakdown of a society.
It's
like
a perfect storm.
There's no doubt about that.
Economic despair from 3 months of not working is unprecedented. You've never had a time where through no fault of your own, you are broke, you can't pay for food, you can't pay your mortgage, you can't pay your rent, and you're fucked, and there's no jobs to be had. It's not like there's anything these kids can go out and do to better their position.
Right.
The amount of jobs that existed just 3 months ago, it's drastically reduced. So their opportunities, which are already slim to none, we're talking about people getting out of college in 2020, that how bad their economic opportunities are before all this in comparison to the past.
How about if you're coming out of high school?
Yes.
And aren't going to go to college? I mean, most people don't go to college.
Right.
And so
that's the people you're seeing smashing windows.
My only point.
Indeed, Joe Rogan correctly links the shutdown and lockdown politics to the unleashing of these riots. And these several of the same political groups were behind that. Several of the same political billionaires supported both. And we should ask questions as to whether or not they are tied to the orchestration and organization of both. Let's go to some of your questions. Let's start with Jefferson in Virginia.
Thank you, Robert, for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Earlier today on David Knight, a man from Virginia named Vince from my neck of the woods, he's a Virginia freeholder proponent. He believes the counties should certainly break away from the state government of Ralph Northam and declare it invalid and have some sort of like a constitute convention in the counties. And I don't know if you're familiar with this whole movement, but it's about time we abolish what's going on. It seems to me we've reached the point where our ship of state has hit the iceberg, and we're still not sure what to do to keep from drowning.
I am familiar with some of those concepts, and a lot of them have a historical, ancestral, intellectual sound roots. It's really the pragmatic politics of the day as to being able to effectuate that without the pushback of the more institutional powers that be at a centralized level. So that's where they'll face difficulty being able to achieve or attain that objective. But at least it's an idea that should be further discussed. I mean, at least originally, if you go back and you can read James Beard's Economic History of the U.S. Constitution, I know about it just because my forefathers, if you go back to all of the Barneses in Rhode Island, we've been in Rhode Island a long time before the country was founded, all of the Barneses originally voted against the original Constitution to change from the Articles of Confederation because it did not include a Bill of Rights. They were also opposed to any national centralized bank. Rhode Island issued its own currency. They're also opposed to any national standing army, fearing that that would concentrate power. If you have one federal centralized institution – or a group of entities or politicians that can, at a national level, control the currency and control the military, control force and control the means of exchange, then power will ultimately flow up and be centralized from it. And their belief was that the power should be as localized as possible. Indeed, not only is the jury trial for both criminal and civil cases under the Sixth and Seventh Amendment intended to make sure the local community judged cases or controversies, whether they be civil or criminal in nature, but in addition, the Second Amendment's provisions was not only a self-defense right, which is what the Supreme Court recognized in just the past decade, but on top of that, the Second Amendment was intended to have a local militia be the means of military enforcement and police enforcement in cases of national emergency, because they wanted people that were rooted in the local community controlling and policing their community, not having a national outside military intervention that could, in effect, lead to a colonial-type governmental power system equivalent to what they remembered from King George, where the redcoats could just go into anybody's house, ransack the house, do what they want, taking orders from a centralized command without being rooted in the local community. Indeed, our contemporary National Guard laws and the combination of the Insurrection Act of 1807, the Posse Comitatus Act of 1877 and 1878, and later various amendments that have been passed as part of the national security, the national defense authorization, all provide for making sure it's the local National Guard that can be activated by the president, or a National Guard in a neighboring state can assist as well in making sure federal civil rights, constitutional rights of ordinary citizens are protected against local lawless activities that may at times involve the complicit participation of local political officials, but it keeps the governing authorities and the emergency intervention something that is of a nature that's like the militia provisions of the Second Amendment that were intended to make sure we have a democratizing mechanism of arms distribution and enforcement and military enforcement as well. And so hopefully the president follows that track. So, but I think the idea that we should have more power decentralized, more power given to people in their local communities, is the right idea. Well, by theory, the principle that the Homesteader principle is articulating does have some historical, ancestral, and intellectual roots of value. As a practical matter and as a pragmatic issue, politically, the powers that be are unlikely to allow that to flourish and develop in a way that can be meaningfully impactful and effective. So I think the idea is the right one, even if that solution may not be the one that ultimately works. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Moses in Texas.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I've been listening to the recent event, and this is something that came to my mind that I feel that should be brought up. Now, in the events leading up to the 2016 election, there was all kind of meddling and things of that sort going on with big tech, right? Big tech, Facebook, all that, right? Now, one concern that came to mind is, what if they decided to do something with the internet or with the social media or something to where they could, you know, something to where they could really make a major communication shutdown around the time of the election? So that way, you know, people can't communicate certain things across. Now, I'm sure they're doing different types of censorship now, but I'm wondering, is there a possibility where they could really make some serious shutdowns to where people can't communicate on or around the election time, and to watch out for any meddling as it relates to communications, big tech and those things. I just wanted to bring that point up. It was something that came across my mind. I didn't know if it was an original thought or something that was already happening, but I just figured that, you know, people should be aware that if big tech is already, you know, meddling, you know, with people's text messages and dashboards, you know, what other bigger things could they do to make sure that the Trump base can't communicate with one another on a bigger level than what is already? I wanted to bring up.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a good question. Really, big tech has three mechanisms by which they can distort and influence election results. The first is by distorting, like, algorithms. So, like, one thing that we're going to start doing as we get closer to the election day is on a daily basis, we're going to show what you would find if you go to DuckDuckGo and search any particular hot topic, and compare that if you go to Google. and show you in live time how that influence is happening. My favorite test case right now is if you go into Google and enter the name Alex Jones, you get one listing of people. But DuckDuckGo, which is an honest algorithm based on what actual searches and information are based on, you'll get a very different set of responses and results. Indeed, Professor Epstein has shown in detail how just by framing what the top five stories are on a Google search list, they can move large numbers of voters one way or the other. So algorithmic manipulation, it's already happening on YouTube. For example, if you go to YouTube and you search certain legal news or legal stories, or if you just open up your YouTube, you're likely to get bombarded with recommended videos from someone known as Legal Eagle. Well, Legal Eagle's a marginal lawyer. He was a corporate associate for a few years, lives in D.C., runs a practice that I've never heard of, and I operate in a lot of civil rights political cases. But he already has a million views for his legal analysis, so-called analysis, of what happened at Lafayette Park, suggesting that it was the equivalent of dictatorial actions and all this other nonsense. So that's another way in which, by manipulating information, manipulating what you see, manipulating what you read, manipulating what you hear. That's stage one. Stage two of what they can do is help identify people. So, for example, there are allegations of manipulation by the LinkedIn founder in the 2017 election of the U.S. senator where Roy Moore lost to the Democratic challenger. And what happened in that context was he created a fake news stories about Russian bots trying to influence the election when he was the one actually behind it and complicit with it, for which he faced no consequences. If you dig into the election results, there was something else that showed up in big tech meddling, potentially, which is that years ago, the Iceland election officer noted that Facebook seemed to send different messages to different people about going out to vote, that basically they could manipulate one half, 1%, maybe more of the vote by just who they sent in a go out to get out to vote message to. So if they send it out to certain groups but not other groups, then they can effectively impact the election just by sending out a message as simple as get out to vote or telling people where their voting precinct is or where and how they can vote. Notably, Twitter tried to edit effectively the president's tweets by saying that voting by mail is a wonderful and great thing, where the president was raising questions about the possibility of fraud. And Twitter did that on a day when they were fact-checking the president saying there's nothing wrong with mail-in voting, on a day that a person was arrested and indicted for using mail-in ballots to corrupt an election. So the utility of it, but that's a second way they can do so. They can basically just by who they send messages to, where, when, and how, what information they have, because remember, Facebook has extraordinary information about you. Facebook can use that private information that they, not only for monetization purposes of their own economic self-interest, but also by politically knowing who to target. Facebook knows and Google knows and YouTube knows based on your search history. Remember, Google was actually tracking people even when they were using private anonymous browsers, they believed, based on what Google had represented. They're now facing a $5 billion suit because it turned out they lied. They were still tracking and tracing people then before tracking and tracing became a pandemic so-called political solution. It's been what Google has been doing to you for decades. And so they are able to know, they know every swing voter in every city, county, and state. So they can use that information selectively to favor one group over another. They can send things into news feeds of select people in ways that 98% of the people will never know even happened and occurred. And that will simply look organic and authentic. For example, in the 2018 elections, there were unusual results. Like in 2017, you could see the potential impact of big tech manipulation because you'd have the same demographic precincts right next to each other. One voted at 90% of the presidential election level of 2016. One voted at 60 to 65% level. So somehow you got, and you could replicate that in precincts, cities, and counties across the state of Alabama. Something that usually is a telltale indicator of some form of voting fraud. So in 2018, you saw similar unusual results. You saw results in one congressional district next to another congressional district in the same state, and one have a disproportionately high Democratic turnout and the other not, even though both were in swing districts where large amounts of money were infused. While Mayor Bloomberg's disproportionate money may have played a role in that, one of the ways they may have done so is with big tech collusion to target specific voters based on information only big tech knows. The third part is what you're talking about. The depriving people of services in one location and maybe giving it to people in other locations. Social media has been a critical organizational and communicative tool for the left. So that will be the main hindrance to them fully shutting it down. The greater risk is that they shut it down selectively. But it's the reason why you should be prepared, both technologically and personally. When you look at the things that InfoWars Store, for example, sells, it includes things like storable food so that you don't have to be dependent upon going to the grocery store if suddenly there's a lockdown like what happened in the pandemic, or the inability of getting to the grocery stores like what's happened with towns riddled by riots. The same concept applies to technology. There's technology like Signal that is an open source technology that's not centrally controlled, doesn't centrally store information that you can use to make sure you can stay in communication. There's a locals.com, something set up by Dave Rubin outside of the big business construct to give people independent platforms to give you independent access. There's Gab that's setting up a competitor to Twitter to make that is going to be more free in its ability to communicate and express. So it's definitely the case that people need to become familiar. There's things like BitChute, an alternative to YouTube, to be able to provide independent access to various media sources and information sources. There's ban.video that puts up all of the different videos that have been banned or blocked by YouTube and the major censors and big tech, big brother operations. So you can start to develop your own independent means of communication so that the risk of them shutting it off at any given moment is a risk that you can survive and sustain. It's definitely a risk. There's no doubt it's a risk. They could use any set of pretexts to do it. Just look at how they've used the lockdown and the riots to achieve aspects of that that we wouldn't have conceived of as even possible just months ago. So that is why and how you can use it. So that is, in fact, a good question. And the best way to do it is to arm yourself with not only independent information, protect yourself by having independent sources of products and independent sources of information, but also start to master the tools that are outside of big tech's controls so that you can continue to be both well-informed and communicate to those you care about without being under big tech's monopoly. So thanks for your call. Let's go to Ryan in California.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Oh, okay. Just some quick questions. I'm a long-time listener, and I'm just trying to make sense of all this going on right now. And I've been, I always look to history to assess the future. And I was wondering, are we going through a regime change right now? Or is the Democratic Party making it very adamant that, Donald Trump is orange man bad, so... I'm just trying to make sense of all these riots, too, and just trying to look how the same situations have affected other countries, and now it's kind of hitting home. So I'm just, again, trying to look to the past to assess the future. So I was wondering what your take on all this right now.
It is definitely a reasoned interpretation of our sequence of events that there are powerful players that in participating in what is taking place, both in the lockdown politics and in the riotous activities taking place, that have in their viewpoint, their goal or their objective, some form of regime change. Indeed, in this respect, it's useful to look at both, as you mentioned, history is often a predictor of the future and often is a template for understanding how things operate. I always recommend to people the American Tabloid trilogy by James Elroy. That's the first book is American Tabloid. The second is Bloods or Rover. The third is The Cold 6000. And what those are about is about what happened between 1963 and 1973. And he helps give a template to how power operates, how the connections between the underworld, rogue intelligence agencies, powerful billionaires can coordinate to be able to affect change that serves their own personal, political, or financial interests against the will of the elected populace and people. Involves how the underworld is connected to that activity, how they're in fact often integral in the same way we've seen criminal underworld elements involved in these riots by helping coordinate using the protest as a pretext to know even where the route is going, to know where they're going to execute certain forms of robbery without being able to be detected or arrested. So we see signs of that. Go back to Barry Seal and just look at all of Barry Seal's unique and unusual history and a famous photo of him from the 1960s where he's sitting next to a whole bunch of other people that would end up becoming either CIA operatives, in one case the director of the CIA, another person who would be involved in all kinds of rogue activities as one of the ex-Cubans who was part of this roaming group of intelligence operatives that show up in unusual circumstances. All of that history has a role to play in particular here as it relates to George Soros. Soros has had a constant, continuous role in trying to destroy government currencies for his own self-enrichment, trying to undermine government systems, using NGOs, non-governmental organizations, spreading propaganda and putting journalists on his secret payroll. But a particular example with that would be, would include the orange and the color velvet and rose revolutions that happened in Eastern Central Europe. But he's someone who believes and has witnessed and has reason to believe that this could actually effectuate real regime change. For that, you can look at the documentary Ukraine on Fire. There they go into detail about how they're able to stage events, including false flag components, try to get an overreaction from the police and military, which I think is part of what's taking place here, to have infiltrators and instigators that are able to effectively circumvent that. And so what happened in the so-called Maidan Revolution in Ukraine in the 2014-2015 timeframe is we were in bed with neo-Nazis, actual neo-Nazis, created the false flag events, and it overthrew the entire government. The elected government of Ukraine had to flee Ukraine. So this is, they've seen it happen throughout Central Europe, throughout Southern Europe. Someone like George Soros grew up witnessing governments getting overthrown and overrun all the time as a young teenager. And he's a guy who decided to saddle up with someone who was taking and confiscating Jewish wealth, and did so and had no shame about it, no guilt about it, even decades later. Just sort of laughed and said, compared it to something that was kind of funny about how he manipulated markets as well. So it gives you the mindset and the mentality of someone who has extraordinary wealth and has built expansive connections using the same methods and modus operandi that our own government and other governments use to destabilize governments all across the world. So we definitely cannot rule out that possibility. And I think that's a good question. I think that is something that we have to at least explore. So thanks for your question. As we wrap up tonight and consider the context of all that has taken place, we cannot rule out who and what is involved, but there are clearly culprits and suspects worthy of more investigation. People who have a history, people who have a record, people whose own policies and own statements implicate their course of conduct. There are those out there who wish to undermine not only this existing government, but as George Soros himself has said, to undermine the United States as well. People whose objective is not in line with our constitutional principles or our American tradition of freedom. In the same capacity that groups like BLM can only exist because the Malcolm X's and Martin Luther King's have been shot and killed, but it's also because they have been suppressed and censored by the combination of big tech and big media. We must continue to be diligent in our task, continue to self-inform ourselves, arm ourselves with education and information to continue to protect freedom. Because the last riders of Revere's ride are the ordinary everyday Americans continuing to act on freedom around the world.